Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires and supported by PNC Bank. It is our week in sports cars with Graham Goodwin. How are you, my dear friend?
It's great. It was a quiet racing weekend, for me at least, this last weekend. So been playing catch up, lots of good stuff on the way for this podcast and as well for Daily Sports Car. Lots to come in terms of analysis of what's going on in the WEC. We'll cover some of that today. And a brilliant bit of news just breaking as we come to sit down and do this podcast, MP, which is that we're going to have ACO Rules LMP Racing back in Australia for the first time since 2000, since the Race of 1,000 Years, the LMP3 Cup comes to Australia. So that could be interesting. Let's watch that with interest. Always good to see more friends coming to endurance racing. But yeah, lots and lots and lots of interest from the listeners. Massive thanks again to our friends of the Reddit community, the RWEC subreddit. Thanks as well to the FIWEC fans page on Facebook. And boy, did you guys get busy on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast Facebook page and on Twitter. A bumper crop of questions, and we're going to have to be rapid fire through them, aren't we, Bob?
Well, yeah, and so blame me, yell at me. It seemed like folks particularly enjoyed the three-hour marathon podcast last week. I am on a series of three-day weeks for the next month plus, so in the office Monday through Wednesday, then traveling Thursday through Sunday, covering events, and then coming back. So it just means that with a compressed week, I don't have 3 hours plus to offer. So we are going to do our best to get through as many things as we can, as many of the great questions that you sent in. Some of them were duplicates or triplicates, which makes our lives a little bit easier because we can roll one theme into one question that satisfies many that have come in. So thank you nonetheless. The response, honestly, it has just been fantastic. And despite this involving me, it seems like you at least enjoy Graham. So that's a really good thing. Also, thank you again to Cooper Tires, and thank you to PNC Bank. And we will be back right after this. PNC is proud to sponsor Scott Dixon, driver of the number 9 car for Chip Ganassi Racing. Everyone tunes in on race day, but so much of the race is determined off camera during the work put in throughout the week, month, and year. From the gym to the practice track, Scott Dixon and the team take small steps every day to get closer to victory lane. Copyright 2018, the PNC Financial Services Group Incorporated. All rights reserved. PNC Bank, National Association, member FDIC. So although we did not have a bevy of sporty car racing last weekend, Graham, I was fortunate to be in Monterey for, I don't know how many times I've covered the what was once called the Monterey Historics, has been called the Rolex Monterey Motorsports Reunion in recent years, and got to see all kinds of sporty car stuff from mid-70s and 80s FIA championship era type cars, a lot of Porsche 935s and their protagonists. There was a delightful IMSA GTO, GTU, GTP, Trans Am class that had, I think, 40 or 50 cars.
Wow.
Was able to do some great, and I don't mean great because I did it, I mean the cars were great, able to do some great in-car camera capturing and also in-car audio. A lot of that audio will be coming here shortly, if not today. Some true delights. But first of all, we had the 1995 Le Mans-winning McLaren F1 GTR, the Ueno Clinic-sponsored, the PP Doctor Mobile. That was part of the McLaren/Zac Brown assembly there, and boy, was it amazing. Had some guy, Finnish guy, by the name of Mika Häkkinen driving it, and so was very thankful to Zach for letting me put cameras on the left and the right of Mika, and for the mechanics for letting me take my small little Roland audio recorder, wrap it in some heat shielding, tuck it in the engine bay on top of the right rear shock tower, which was fairly close to the exhaust outlets. And it is just V12 glory. I captured, I think, last year, Graham, maybe the year before, with BMW, they let me put my recorder in their F1 GTR, except for it was in the cockpit. And with the carbon fiber firewall and everything else, was a bit muted. I can tell you there was no muting here whatsoever. So that made me super happy. The best, though, I think, was Zach let me put my audio recorders in, two audio recorders and three in-car cameras in his 1988 SCCA Trans Am Audi 200. And yeah, this is one of my favorite vehicles of my youth. Having seen the car run back in the day originally, I felt old realizing it was 30 years ago. The last time I saw this car was 30 years ago. But the fun part, and Zach, he might be the CEO of McLaren Racing and have a high profile, blah, blah, blah. We didn't speak a word about modern racing, F1, Alonso, IndyCar, none of that stuff. The only thing we spoke about were these vintage cars that we loved. He's a racer himself, a real racer at heart. And he just knows, I think, by now to just let me do my thing. I mean, I ask, obviously, but he says, yeah, go to town, do whatever. So working with United Auto Sports, great mechanics, was able to not only put one audio recorder kind of right above the exhaust outlet that goes through the passenger side on the right and out the door, but also a second one in the engine bay less than a foot away from the turbo in order to get the turbo flutter. And so in the video that I put together, you got three different angles, but I took the audio next to the exhaust, the one next to the turbo, put them together, and you get an accurate representation of being Walter Röhrl, Hans Stuck, Hurley Haywood, you name it. So, yeah, I'm still giggling about that. Other thing I'll mention too, Graham, and I wish you could have been there, obviously, but part of the brilliance of the reunion, I assume, being at Goodwood, whether it's heading up the mountain or the actual track racing event that they do, is just the people you get to see, some that you might not have seen for a little while. I happen to be texting back and forth with a wee Scot by the name of Alan McNish, because I'd heard him on the PA system talking about something. I'm like, hey, when did you get here? He had to run, said he was coming back the next day, so we caught up outside of the little Rolex driver's pavilion thing, and he and I were there just chatting about whatever, and Tom Christensen walks by and comes over. So I'm sitting here staring at the wee Scot on my right, this great, great Dane on my left. Then their heads snap and they see Dr. Ulrich, Wolfgang Ulrich, walks over with his son. And I'm like, you're kidding me. We've got an informal Audi sport reunion and I'm just talking to some friends, but what am I doing here? I don't belong. Dr. Ulrich was with his son. And so we have these legends of Le Mans with 18 million victories between all of them. And then Marino Franchitti rocks up. See him, give him a great big hug. Then my friend Harley Cluxton, Le Mans winning entrant, who was there running the disqualified 1982 Mirage M12 he built and entered for Michael and Mario Andretti. He walked up, and I'm just sitting there. Dear listeners, I might have said this before, but yes, this is what I do. This is what Graham does. This is our profession. We're very serious about what we do and, you know, established. And there's still a point where, I mean, I'm 47 years old, man, and I'm still going, holy crap, Alan McNish, Dr. Ulrich, Tom Christensen, Harley Cluxton, and, you know, Marino's a dear friend, but still, yeah, I just stand back at times and go, A, I have the best job in the world, and B, I can guarantee you none of them are standing there saying, oh my God, it's Marshall Pruitt. So there's a proper, appropriate placement. Now,
in fairness, mate, they might be going, oh my God, it's Marshall Pruitt.
Oh my God. So anyways, there's just a healthy, no matter how old I get, how long I've been doing this, honestly, there's just an ongoing appreciation that these legends, some of them who I'm fortunate enough to have become friends with, they're still frickin' legends, and it's just really cool. So all that stuff aside, I wish you could have been there. It was a blast, just a blast, to see all the cars, everything that was taking place there. Did some other stuff that will be going up here on Racer.com shortly, some in-car with a 1986 All-American Toyota's All-American Racers Toyota Celica, as it's pronounced in some portions of the world, or Celica here. That would be one of the craziest turbocharged four-wheel, four-cylinder engined beasts we've had in IMSA GTO. Did a couple things with an 85 March Buick GTP car that was on pole at Daytona in 1985, and some fun stuff with Mazda and their RX792P, driven by young IMSA star Tristan Nunez. So it was a great weekend,
have any
brother.
Fun at all, did you? You
no,
didn't have any fun
it,
at all.
It was punishment.
There was one major endurance event over the weekend. It wasn't in North America.
I've heard it was a cluster. Shall we open with that? Because I don't know. Other than reading folks' reactions to commentary in particular, it sounds like fun. You wanna let's get rocking and rolling on questions.
Well, first thing first, it was indeed the Suzuka 10 Hours latest round of the Intercontinental GT Challenge, SRO's global product, which will add the Kalami race to the product next year. So it brings together lots and lots of GT3 racing at the fabled Suzuka circuit. First time in a good long time it's been a SRO run, or rather SRO involved event. Great race, for what little I saw of it, I have to say. Good race. 1-2 for Mercedes-Benz. Excellent result for Mercedes-Benz AMG. Audi chased them hard at the end, but couldn't quite make it. But it is fair to say that the principal thing that came out of this was there was a bit of a mess up, really. It wasn't an SRO promoted event. It was a MobilityLand promoted event. And I think SRO stumbled into a bit of a mess because whilst we're used to their events being on their GT World YouTube platform and elsewhere, free to view worldwide, with a pretty good standard of commentary, not so much here. And while some markets did get goodly portions of the race free to view eventually, others didn't. And the ones that did had, how can you put this, a rather unconventional commentary. It's part of the circuit radio broadcast there, and clearly not intended for an international audience. Basically, yes, one lady with a fair amount of information about what was going on and what wasn't, and someone else interacting with them, sort of local DJ style.
What? Hey, there goes a pass in turn three.
No, not even that good. No, it was... And I don't like doing this, because, I make part of my living from commentary, but
yes,
it doesn't
but
feel
you're horrible,
good to say.
And we know that. So
yeah,
there's
it doesn't feel good to say
that.
It was all around terrible. I will say this:
room for improvement.
Two levels. There's two levels of response to it. One was, it would have been nice to hear from SRO that actually this was a bit of an error. I have literally zero doubt whatsoever that it will not happen again like that. And in fact, the full highlights of the race, over an hour, already up online on GT World with the excellent David Addison doing commentary on those as if he were there. But the reality was, on this occasion, it rather let that down. So actually, one of the very few occasions when I can honestly say there were very long periods where there was no commentary whatsoever, and that was probably better than the commentary you got. That's enough said. There is one question amongst others. We've had Right Turn Lover and I think it's Dennis Socek. If that's wrong, Dennis, to apologise. And Cookie Monster from the Reddit group, all asking about that. But also Cookie Monster asking about interaction with the stands with LEDs at night. Excellent stuff. And what can I remember about interaction with fans? Well, the Radio Le Mans bit was very often we got to, I remember being on the receiving end of one of them, and I've been the delivery end of one of them. And we ask for a reaction from Radio Le Mans from the stands. It comes immediately, and it comes to a very surprising degree. It is pretty amazing to see, a goodly proportion of a very, very, very large crowd responding to what they're hearing through their ears. And I know that just about everybody, whether or not it be Graham Tyler back in the day, whether or not it's Joe Bradley now, whether or not it's the late lamented Janice Minton, or whether or not it's the guys and girls in the booth, on the odd occasion, we don't do it often, the crowd literally rises when you ask them to do so to the occasion. Fabulous, fabulous stuff. But anyway, Suzuka, great race, poorly presented, I'm afraid, in that instance. Won't be a mistake that they make again. It is not their normal way of doing things, and I think they'll have learned the lesson and learned it very hard indeed. Enough said.
So you, being the efficient man that you are, have grabbed all of the questions, tried to distill them into categories and whatnot. We have 8 pages of questions. So this, and again, it's awesome. It is truly awesome. And what I don't want to do is linger too long. I would rather answer more questions in a shorter capacity than the opposite. So let's start off with some items from the LMP1 category. Matthew Pig, do you think that EOT, Equivalence of Technology, needs looking at again? And I would say, Matthew, yes and always. I wouldn't even qualify it with again. I would just say yes. Even when EOT was working properly-ish, it's still something that anytime you apply some sort of artifice to create parity or similarity, if things get out of whack, then you need to look at it. We have something different where, as you know, Graham, EOT was really intended to be the thing that governed the big P1 hybrids, disparate technologies altogether, diesel, petrol, turbo, single, double, whatever, different grades of hybrid delivery power. This was something meant to keep different ideas at least playing in the same park. Now we have an attempt to take one hybrid and make it play with cars that were never really intended to be at that level to be together. So without overstating the obvious, it's been a season-long problem in the WEC, and I would say going into every race, there will be questions as to if the measures have been enough to make the next round at X competitive, and then coming out, we kind of expect the same question. Maybe this just needs to be a standard one, Matthew, that we cut and paste into every episode, because I think it might be a topic.
It's a really complicated issue, without a shadow of a doubt. I think the theory behind what they were trying to do was a worthy one. The reality didn't take into account 2 or 3 issues. One was commercial reality of having one factory team. 2 was the politics involved in that. 3 was the actual problem is not so much that the hybrid cars are faster over a given lap. The reality is that the non-hybrid cars are not that much slower over an individual lap, certainly not the kind of gaps that we're seeing in the race. And that's because of the mind-melting acceleration through and away from traffic that these cars are capable of. And when you've got races of 6 hours and longer, with the number of overtaking opportunities or necessities, rather, that come their way, that is what is causing a major part of the problem. I think the rulemakers massively underestimated the task in hand. I think they have had their fingers burned clean off as a result of that. It is very clear that the teams, and for that matter, the vast majority of the fan base are, I would say, up in arms about this matter. I honestly cannot, for those commercial and political reasons, see anything changing this side of Fuji, but I cannot believe it will be allowed to go on like this very much longer. And the reason for that, it's a conversation I've been having with various people involved in the decision-making process, from factory matters, from the team matters, and for the rulemaking matters. The reason for that is this is not just what we keep being told, a transitional year. It's not a transitional year. It's a transitional season that is 18 months long. But beyond that, MP, it's another year, because before the cavalry arrives with the 2020 regulations, which let's not forget is 2020-2021, yeah, so it's summer 2020, we have another full season. They've got to make this work, because right now you cannot guarantee, you certainly can't guarantee, and you certainly wouldn't be able to count on anybody else wanting to join the LMP1 party if the disparity is as wide as it currently is. They need to think really hard about how they're going to sustain this class for effectively 2 whole seasons, 2 traditional seasons, because whilst we've had 3 races, we've now got 12 months to wait until the next season 2019-2020. Big questions arising here. For me, there is only one answer that makes any sense whatsoever. Yes, you can tinker with it. We can do what they need to do about equalising pit stop times. But what they actually need to do is to sit down, have a solid conversation with Toyota, get Toyota to embrace what I think is the inevitable, is those cars are going to be slowed down.
Matthew also had one follow-up, Graham. Will Ginetta be back at Fuji?
I hope so. I should say, by the way, thanks, Matt. Matt is one of the two administrators of the FIE supporters group on Facebook. Certainly lots of people working very hard to make that happen. There are some commercial reasons, as there have been, plaguing this throughout. The reality is that those difficulties are between the two partners in TRSM, the Chinese end and the UK-based end, that everybody appears to be trying to make it work, but someone is going to have to pony up the money to make that change official. So the answer is, at the moment, people are still attempting to make this work. It would be great to think that it will happen. I hope it does happen. There's just about everybody involved here would like it to happen. But ultimately, it's going to come down to whether or not money changes hands, agreements can be kept, and, you know, the paperwork can be filed. But so I can tell you that there is a car waiting to go.
Another LMP1 related question here from Richard Parsons, and I'll take the last part for us. Curious about the Baikalis chassis and entry with the Nissan engine and its struggles, a Nissan engine built by Cosworth. And he said, great show, keep it up. Yes, sir, we will. Interesting, Graham. The Baikalis folks have never worked with a budget that would put them in the league of anyone they've raced. They, once they've gone to their own chassis, that chassis itself has been constantly developed. It has had different engines powering it and whatnot. From the outside, I think if we just skip the lack of comparable funding and possibly lack of same technical depth, if you have something that's always changing, it's very hard to get the best out of it. I realize that part of development is searching for the best iteration of something. But we're not talking about, aha, we keep evolving our suspension geometry or a wing profile a little bit. We're talking about big wholesale changes. And so when you have that going on, these are big swings that if you don't have a lot of money to do this, you rarely get to that place. Second part I would say as well, with the X2015 originated Cosworth twin turbo V6 engine, it's not as if that engine was heavily, heavily developed, to my knowledge at least, after the Nissan LMP1 program wound down. So while I think that motor has a ton of potential, I think we also have a case where, just as the Baikalis team is trying to learn and improve their LMP1 chassis, I think the folks at Cosworth/Nissan are also doing the same in a new installation. So it's more of a learning curve to overcome than, boy, they're just miles off and there's no potential to tap into.
In fairness, for this season, a huge amount of development has gone in. Realistically, last year, that car was running in, that engine rather was running in more or less exactly the same form as it was in the front end of the Nissan. Of course, that meant that it was an engine specifically designed for a front-wheel drive car. All of that optimization for the Nissan has now been swept away. There was a thorough going through of that engine. It effectively is more or less an all new unit. More power, more reliability, they certainly hope. A lot of the issues I know may well be down to installation, but we're now talking about an engine that produces, I am told, a reliable 700 horsepower. And hopefully, if the Baikalis guys can actually get around to some of the installation issues that they've been having through the last couple of seasons, we might start to see some of the potential unlocked. I hope so. You know, they're a plucky bunch, and there's some good guys around that squad. But certainly, there is no longer the veil, if you like, that they could say it's because it was an engine designed to run with a hybrid. Realistically, that is now a de facto standalone unit.
Let's jump down to Alex O'Bara, who asks a question in the IMSA DPI range. He says, in regards to DPI, what do you think the chances are of any new manufacturers, besides potentially Ford, of coming in during the current rules period? Mentioned this before, Alex. If it does happen, I will be very surprised. If myself, Graham, was placed into a manufacturer boss role and were asked, hey, should we do DPI now? I would say absolutely not. And that's just because IMSA has said that by 2022, an all-new prototype formula will be used. What that is, we don't exactly know. We think it's going to be an American iteration of DPI. Realize that DPI is an American iteration of LMP2. I think where we're going to end up is IMSA just saying, this is ours, and we're going to keep doing this, so we're no longer leaning on FIWEC constructs. We're just going to do our own thing. But whatever it is, the development time, the design time, that's going to want to kick off in 2020-ish, mid-2020 at least, to have a car on the ground testing mid-2021, to then be racing, going to the Roar before the 24, the first week of 2022. So if I'm looking at, you know, mid to late 2020, and we are not too far from 2019, mate, well, I'm probably not telling someone, yes, let's commission this program, hit the track end of 2019 or the beginning of 2020, and then in theory only get 2 years out of life cycle with that car, knowing we're going to almost have to jump right into designing the next car for the next set of regulations. So
I guess what depends on here is it's almost the trap that the ACO has set for themselves, and it's a matter of whether or not IMSA repeat that cycle. I don't want to say error, but cycle, which is if you get out early enough and tell people what it is you're going to do, then there is the potential to actually have a platform that could cross two rule sets. If, however, you leave it too late, you're almost damning people to make choices they wouldn't make if they knew what was coming. So if we do get much more detail from IMSA of what changes might come with the next rule set, there is the potential to actually get those people with bridging programs. The problem at the moment for the ACO on the other side, if you like, with LMP1 moving into GTP/hypercar/ please tell us what it's going to be called, guys. Mm-hmm. That way we have to stop saying things like that, is that, you know, that we have had an outline presented. What it effectively tells us immediately is that every powertrain and every chassis that we've currently got will at best be grandfathered, because it certainly won't be compliant when we get to 2020, 2021. So, and we don't yet have the outline regulations beyond that. I'd say there's a challenge here for IMSA. The challenge here for IMSA is get it out the traps early, and you may have an opportunity for those chassis manufacturers, with the guys at the moment who are driving a lot of this development, or indeed other aspirant manufacturers, to potentially come forward and have effectively a development program before the full program.
You raise a brilliant point. What do you think, Graham? So we know that IMSA has said they're going to stick with our friends at the ACO and FIA all the way to the very end on this hypercar GTP, whatever we're going to call it. Let's just call it car. How's that? That's as asinine and meaningless as any other name. They're going to stick and through the very end of the rule creation and development process for whatever the 2021 car top LMP1-ish type thing is going to be. What are the negatives? If they said, okay, well, we'll still send somebody, we'll still pick up the phone when there's a conference call, but just letting you know, today, whatever it is, the 28th of August, we're going to plant a stake in the ground and say, this is what we're doing in America, period, and let us know what you end up with as well, because, yeah, we might adopt it in the future, but essentially, we're not going to wait for you to come to the end of your road to then start determining our road. What kind of political blowback, what kind of relationship damage might that do? Or could it be a really strong power play?
I think the answer is, I believe the ACO can see that the inevitable will happen in any case. I don't believe at the moment they can get to a financial level with the new car regulations that will satisfy where IMSA want to be. I think we could be heading for a position which, you know, rather remarkably, There's not a massive amount of difference in terms of philosophy between the two regulations. I think there'll be a million miles in terms of the chassis. It looks to me like the GTP chassis, the car chassis, will be fundamentally different from, you've got it now, haven't you? Well, fundamentally different from the LMP2 based current DPI. And you know, if the DPI 2.0 retains that, which I think they probably will, because that's where you get a lot of the cost savings from. You could end up with the remarkable situation where there's not a vast amount of difference apart from the chassis and the aero. And it is a pretty remarkable situation, isn't it? Where I know people are screaming at the moment at their selected streaming device, but what about hybrid? Sorry, guys, but there's no guarantee that DPI 2.0 won't do something not dramatically different. We don't know that yet, and there's been all sorts of rumours that perhaps they might, whether or not it be a standardised this or a bolt on that. The reality is we could end up with DPI 2.0 and car, being remarkably similar concepts, couldn't we? And yet still have missed the goal of a global formula.
car convergence. Yes, those are conversations that will be held. Oh Lord, we're already spinning off into the guardrail here. All right, I'll take one more, and then why don't you grab five or six? Let's go to LMP2, our man Andrew of the Baxter tribe. Given the potential low interest in IMSA P2, talking about 2019 when we
By the
split
way, this is a
classes,
great question. This is a really good question.
it is. Why is the class visiting every track DPI visits? A reduced schedule would not only reduce budgets, which we've seen work wonders for the ELMS, removing a track like Detroit, which classes with Le Mans test day for a class, which awards a Le Mans entry, seems like an actual no-brainer. If you were making a reduced schedule for P2s, what would it be? He says, I'd suggest Daytona Sebring, Road America, Mosport, and Petit Le Mans. Detroit and Watkins Glen both dropped due to Le Mans timing. I think you not only are onto something great there, Andrew. I also hate the fact that I hadn't thought of this first because I'm supposed to be thinking of these things for a living.
Yeah, write it now before you put the podcast up.
Yes, hold on just a sec. We're stealing ideas from our listeners. If I had a wider raised brow on this, Graham, it's I don't know what the P2 class is going to look like next year, which Andrew opens with. But if we're talking about three cars, then full time. If we're talking about three cars, if folks are going to opt in for three, then I figure let them play full time and enjoy the show. If we are talking about feedback coming in for possibly five, six, seven, and folks saying, okay, but the costs are still brutally high. When I interviewed United Autosports co-owner Zach Brown, whatever it was, a month ago on the topic of P2 versus DPI, would you be okay if IMSA split the classes? Beyond providing his answer there, one of the justification points in saying I wouldn't support it is the costs of P2 are not drastically less than DPI. So his whole point was, look, if we're still paying more or less full boat for P2, but we're now second tier and really aren't expected to go for the overall win, tell me what I'm missing here for incentives, because I'm paying a lot, but getting less in terms of potential results. So if we're still in that position, Andrew, I would say, and folks are giving IMSA the feedback, telling them, look, we could be interested in doing P2, but boy, like Zach or maybe some others have said, cut that budget in half and we'll be in for, this five, six round championship. I think you would see it. We already see it, Graham Dunnell, to some degree with GT Daytona, for example, where they try and, have tried, especially in recent years, to knock a couple of rounds off of the list just to reduce budgets there.
Good points. There's a couple of other points, by the way, on LMP2, both of which actually revolve around this rule cycle from 4SGT on Reddit. Nick Detweiler asking about whether or not there's been any announcement, any thoughts about future of the current P2 with the upcoming 2020 LMP1s being based on a more road car-like feel to them. The answer is no. I think they've got all their available brain power being directed in the direction of LMP1 or car-car. And that will come along, other than to say that there is a fair amount of opinion around that perhaps the error that was made with LMP2, if an error indeed it was that perhaps they are a little too capable, a little too quick. So, you know, we know that the newer top class of prototype look like they're going to be reeled in a tad. Whether or not that heralds a slight reeling in of the capabilities of the next generation LMP2, we'll wait and see. I'll pick a couple. Let's go with a couple of GT questions. Adam Bowman asks, almost all manufacturers use a different car for their GT4, GT3 and GTE efforts. How come Aston Martin relies solely on the Vantage for all of their racing efforts? It was a policy decision made with the last platform, Adam, where they decided, because of course DBR9 and et al. Were based on the DB9 platform. There's all sorts of reasons why that made sense at the time, didn't make sense moving forward. Things like wheelbase, etc., optimum, you know, the optimum platform for various formula, the majority of the tracks they go to. But they did make the decision to go with effectively their volume model, and very clearly with we've now seen the new GT3 out there testing, and the GT4 soon to follow publicly, that they're going to follow through with that. That is going to be the model that is, you know, the one you're most likely to see on the street with Aston Martin. And you have to say, commercially, with Andy Palmer at the wheel of Aston Martin, and rumours, by the way, circulating today that he's going to be taking that company to the stock market, the answer is that it looks like Aston Martin Lagonda are flying along at the moment. So it looks like that is a policy that has paid, literally, will pay dividends for them. Some guy called Percy, that is actually his logger name.
Win feels Percy, like possibly? No, hold on.
Absolutely. Feels like a few months ago there were rumours here, there and everywhere about every car manufacturer under the sun building a car to race in GT Pro, but almost overnight everything fizzled out. We stopped hearing anything altogether. What happened? Well, I can tell you about a couple of them. The public statements we've heard from the likes of Lamborghini, I think there is a degree of confusion. There's also some internal machinations within the VAG group, of which Lamborghini are part of that. That certainly they did have an evaluation of GT underway. I suspect that with what's been going on with the prototype formulae, that they're looking again at what their options might be. Will we see something coming forward in the near future from Lamborghini? Not sure at the moment. I think that's gone all rather quiet. I think they're pushing hard with their GT3 customer programs, and of course the opportunity to promote the brand through these major global races. And of course, we're now getting to the stage where the Huracan is getting to be a reasonably old platform. So they're going to be looking at a next generation car. McLaren, okay, Geneva show. We saw the Senna GTR. Which rather mysteriously, you might have thought, had position lights on the door of what was a track-only customer car. Rubbish. Of course, that was a GTE car. And that was a very late business-led strategic decision by McLaren as a group to decide not to push the button on a GTE program. We know now that they're looking corporately at the 2020 regulations for potential top-class car coming back to Le Mans and the WEC. We know, too, that there's potential for some form of customer deal with engines for a DPI with United Autosports. That much we do know is in conversation, at least.
It's like guy named Graham Goodwin said that last week, I believe.
Indeed. But so that's certainly two of them. Beyond that, well, you know, I think there is a degree of concern and confusion at the moment about the way this is actually all going to play out in terms of DPI, in terms of P1. It does have an effect in terms of the questions that are being asked at a corporate level of those people that advise the decision makers. So people are stepping back to see where these pieces actually just fall into place before programs are actually, you know, buttons are pushed. So the machinations about DPI 2.0 and CAR-CAR are actually having an effect in other classes too. So let's wait and see what actually happens from there. A fair number of the guys actually spotting the pictures that were doing the rounds earlier last week with the brand new McLaren 720S GT3. Good looking car out in its first public iterations of testing, at least first pictures of it testing. Donald Ducky Howe, great name, does the new McLaren 720S GT3, though gorgeous, begin what we fear of GT3 beginning to get way too expensive, with the chances of overall was win less than well, you know, let's have a quick look there. And Alex Eichmiller asking, with the announcement that McLaren 720S GT3, is there anything beyond meeting SRO's requirements for the car to be eligible for IMSA competition? What is the process for fielding a new car in IMSA? Well, let's deal with that with McLaren both ways around. Number one, the cost of the McLaren, something like €440,000, I think, cheaper than a Ferrari. Ferrari are not struggling to sell cars. McLaren is a brand that has a record of actually getting hold of those people that are looking for provenance on a race car, not only to win, but also to retain some of its value. They are clearly of the opinion, and they'll have done their own market research, that is a price point that, one, they can make money, that's important, two, that they can actually gain and retain customers, that's very important. As for the IMSA side, MP,
money, 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 sorry, that would be involving paying IMSA to become an official manufacturer, which has been a barrier that has kept McLaren, it has kept Aston Martin, except for, I know that there's been a little bit of interesting transactions going on so that a car could compete at Daytona, for example, or very limited. But for the most part, it is shelling out money to become an official manufacturer in order to then be eligible to compete. And we have heard from manufacturers like McLaren saying that with the volume of cars that we sell for competition in North America, the amount of money being asked, and it's not just straight cash, but also a commitment to spending a sizable amount in possible marketing activation, whether it's ads in a newspaper, in online, TV commercials going into a greater pool to help pay for such things to bring awareness to the WeatherTech Championship. There are some of the smaller marks that have balked at that. Others have not. So even though we have some awesome McLaren 720S GT3-age going on and some other cars, which we would love to see in IMSA, Bentley Continental comes to mind as one, or we have heard from, whether it's Mike Say or Brian Gush and such, saying, yeah, we'd love to have them there. But the cost to do so is prohibitive on the sanctioning body level. We don't get all of the world's coolest GT3 cars participating in the WeatherTech Championship's GT Daytona class.
Yep, that is the reality of what it takes to put together that package, and, you know, the breadth of the package in terms of the support that it actually gets in publicity terms is fed by that. You know, for all the excellent streaming media that you actually get, someone's going to pay for it, and that is IMSA's method of ensuring that there is a budget to pay for these things. Let's have a quick look a little bit further down here. One quick one here, it was actually a follow-up from Donald Ducky Howe. Why do we think the European interest seems higher next year to run LMP2 at the Daytona 24 hours with the split of DPI and LMP2? I'll take that one, because I think it's been me that's been asking the questions and getting the answers from the European teams. It's very simple. Last year, the high profile European teams coming to Daytona were the likes of United Autosports, Jackie Chan DC Racing, where they literally stacked those cars with really very talented young men indeed. You know, current Formula One drivers, Formula One test drivers, etc., etc. They're not interested in coming and doing that to win a class. They were only going to be interested in doing that to come and win overall. the fact that now you have effectively put a, you know, chain link fence and a oily dog and a rope around that set of regulations on Pro-Am means that those teams whose business model is very much different, a more traditional Pro-Am, that now don't feel as if to compete they have to, you know, go through the Rolodex and find, you know, last year's you know, hot shoe from Formula Two or someone at the back of the grid in Formula One that might want several thousand of your 2019 budget to come and do one race. The reality is they can look after their own loyal customers and their pro drivers and maybe one of their mates who might want to put a few thousand dollars in the pot to come and see whether or not they can take it on one of the greatest races, endurance races in the world, at Daytona 24 Hours, and win a class. That would be fine. They'd love to have what Alec Minish hasn't got, which is a Rolex watch.
Hashtag an oily dog on a rope. I have no idea where you get some of this stuff, Goodwin, but good Lord, it is worth the price of admission. You are a silly man. Where should we go next, my friend?
Let's have a quick look. Driver rankings. This is a good one. Right Turn Lover and Michael Sorensen with something on a similar kind of theme. With the drivers keeping their greeting during the season, are we likely to see WC teams go super silver hunting in the pre-Le Mans part of the IMSA and LMS season? Yes. It's a process that carries on all the way through. I have regular conversations with some surprising people in paddocks around the world asking, you know, what I've spotted in my travels, you know, with some of the junior and feeder formulas. And you will see some of the results of some of those conversations when you start to see, for instance, European Le Mans Series, you know, squads coming together. I had a call from the representative one driver last night to thank me for putting me in touch with the team he will be driving for next year. Michael Sorensen says, well, what about driver gradings in particular in P2? The likes of Andrea Pizzitola makes the Pro-Am concept look silly. I tend to agree. It's a cross we at the moment having to bear. I am a firm fan of actually taking the process, throwing it away and starting again and making it a lot simpler. I'm of the view that it should be just three ranks. It should be gold, it should be silver, it should be bronze. Gold is gold. It's a full professional driver. Silver, you've got to put some walls around it. But basically, it is either a very young pro driver or someone who is aspiring to be a pro driver. And in bronze, it is people who are not earning a living doing this. However, my view is that if you want to go and stretch your competitive nature, like Simon Dolan, for instance, in Europe, then you should be able to opt to be a silver. You should be able to opt to be up to there to be competing with a different peer group level. I just think it needs another look. I think we've had it long enough now. The teams, the championships understand this process, but I think, Michael, you're right. I think it is being observed most often in the finding the ways around it, and it's maybe about time we had a response to that. Rather than fiddling with the rule book, rather than making it more complex, which we're extremely good at doing, rather than having a process that just gets more and more confusing, let's do the thing we don't often do, throw it away, and if we're going to bring it back in a far more simple fashion.
Surprised no one's come up with a t-shirt, Graham, of a bar of silver with a cape and just kind of a subtle
super know, silver.
Super silver. Yes, that would be a wonderful little thing. Let's have a bit of fun here because we do get some good fun questions. Rob Chalmers says, Graham and Marsall, you're leading the GT class and you look in the mirror. What would you rather see? A BMW-sized Ford GT? Or 10 Ford GT sized BMWs. I would rather see one BMW sized Ford GT because it'd just be hilarious to have something that swollen and ridiculous looking. The thought of having 10 BMWs behind me, yeah, I'm thinking I would not have a lot of body panels left if I had 10 of those things to deal with. So I'll go with the one BMW size 4 GT.
I'm just telling you, they're not getting by me if I'm in front of them. I'm telling you right now, I would employ my normal computer gaming tactic of, yep, you can come there, but you're going to end up in the wall. I don't play fair. It's as simple as that. That's one of the reasons I'm not a racing driver. I don't play fair. We'll just have to wait and see. We'll add a quick one here just because I've spotted it from Clement Rosin. With Aston Martin absent from ELMS racing this year, when, if at all possible, do you think we might see Beechteen MR racing under ACO Wheels Racing again? Well, they were looking very hard indeed at doing the WEC this current season. And major reason why not is because, of course, they would have had to have done it with the older car. With the availability of new cars going forward, I would like to think that Andrew Howard and his mighty group of the fastest ice cream men in the world might well be actually back taking a step up from the British GT Championship. We will see.
Let's see. I'm just trying to... We've got 8 pages, so I'm trying to find something. Oh, there was a Gerard Nouveau, Pierre Fillon, and Scott Atherton sighting last weekend at in Monterey at WeatherTech
yes.
Raceway Laguna Seca. I'd spoken with Scott, so I knew he was there. Then someone showed me a photo of Scott speaking with Gerard and Pierre. And boy, I wish I'd been there because I would have really wanted to listen in or eavesdrop or something like that.
I think they went to was it Pebble Beach last week as well?
Yeah, they bought.
I think they were there too.
Yeah, I think they bought an old Porsche 962 that was up for auction. This comes in from Hubcap Motors, a delightful name. I hope that's the name of an actual business because that is too glorious. It says, "Hi, Graham. Thank you for taking our questions again. Gerard Nouveau has been reported to have said there is an opportunity for an additional WEC race sometime between January and April in 2021. What would be your short list of likely candidates, given the time frame? Could it be a return to COTA,
nope.
given the proximity to the Brazilian and Sebring rounds?"
Hell no. No, it won't be COTA. Sepang, I think, is the one that I would suggest would be very firmly in the frame. I know it's a location that is keen to attract an international event. They are actively promoting Malaysian motorsports. Look on the side of the number 37 Jackie Chan DC racing car and WEC. It is backed, as are the three drivers, by Sepang International Circuit. That is not by accident. I think that is a very high ranking possibility. We know that other tracks have gone a-looking for it. You're absolutely right. It would have to make sense in terms of the logistics. There is time to bring the cars back by the slowboat. We will not be having a prologue in Paul Ricard, Monza, or anywhere else this year. So effectively, what you're looking for is something to bridge that gap between Brazil and Sebring. Sepang might do it. So I'd have thought that was the most likely option of those available. Mexico, maybe. It's sort of the right area, but financially, I don't think that made very much sense for them when we visited there previously. So Sepang definitely, I think, would be one that would be actively considered. But let's wait and see what comes out the mix. Again, we are told a number of circuits are interested in looking at it. That tends to be something that perhaps doesn't turn into solid inquiries once the realities of an FIA sanctioning fee come into play.
Sepang, it's an endurance race and a sauna. It's two for one. There's unrivaled value there. Let's take one more question here, schedulely fun, coming in from AE Racer. This IMSA recently made a change in the calendar with COTA and Mid-Ohio swap. Otherwise, it's been pretty steady. If we were in control, is there any other venue or race length you would like to change? And AE Racer says, if it were me, I'd love to see a longer race back at Road America, something expressed by a lot of people. Actually, during our live podcast there as well, Graham, with where we had Scott Atherton, IMSA president, on our panel, and there was a rousing response to that. Lots of applause of wanting more than just the 2-hour and 40-minute race. And AE Racer says, I'd love to see that longer race back Road America, though I'm not sure what I'd be willing to give up for that if I'm looking at all the places we go, I mean, there are a couple things where I'm struggling on the giving up part and what exactly would be given up. I know that Long Beach is important to some manufacturers. Mazda's North American headquarters is within half an hour of the track. Honda Performance Development is within 40-ish minutes of the track. There are a number of auto manufacturers nearby. So I know that Long Beach holds a lot of importance. It's also a great, I think it is clearly IMSA's number one wine and dine event in a major metro. When IMSA turns up to Monterey, obviously there's great corporate hospitality on the Gulf and that kind of more traditional end. But going to a race where things look big and important and lots of fans, and it just, there's a buzz, there's nothing like Long Beach. At the same time, the racing is not always great. So I'd say two quick things that come to mind. One is, while I love the GT-only event at Virginia International Raceway, it does strike me as a venue that is so awesome. It deserves every class within the WeatherTech Championship there. If we're talking about having to bring in something totally new and maybe get rid of something, boy, again, I'm struggling on the get rid of. Detroit is the clear one. Most people despise that event. Obviously, we have General Motors based there with Fords and GTLM, with the Cadillacs and Corvettes there, it just in the shadow of GM's global headquarters. I don't foresee that falling off the calendar. If by chance some of IMSA's most prominent manufacturers, Graham, say, moved out of Michigan and Detroit was no longer something where there was great commercial synergy, I would say we drop Detroit and add what was once on the Grand Am calendar that I still get to see on the open wheel side, but not on the sports car side in any kind of complete capacity. And that is Alabama and Barber Motorsports Park.
Ooh.
Yeah. Now, wouldn't want too many cars. I have to admit, the full, in theory, I guess next year would be four classes. It might be more of a prototype and GTLM only, because with too many cars, I think the quality of racing would suffer, just not being able to pass without hitting big packs of cars. But it is such an amazing track to see cars go around on, Graham. Beautiful place. One of the best race automotive and also motorcycle racing museums on the planet. And it is just, it can be a rocking and rolling place in terms of race quality. So I would look to trade Detroit for Barber.
I'm going to leave you with that. I mean, I will put both hands up here and say I've not done nearly enough of the different circuits in the US to be an expert on that front, other than to say that I always do feel a little bit shortchanged at just over 2 hours in around North America, around Road America. I do find the irony here. There's a couple of questions up and down here, again asking about this decision from the WEC about 4-hour races, 6-hour races, 8-hour races, and I simply have not had the opportunity to get stuck into that debate with the powers that be. Unfortunately, I have to spend, particularly at Silverstone, where these stories all broke, a lot of my time in a TV booth, but we will get there with the guys. It does strike me, it's a bit of an irony that what we've got is a lot of the people who are, if you like, WEC fans principally, turning and saying we think the IMSA product may be competitive or better. But generally speaking, guys, those races are shorter still than the races you're saying are too short. Mm. It does strike me as being a bit of an irony. Let's see what comes out in the wash here. For me, I just can't get terrifically excited about race lengths once we get over about the 4-hour mark. You know, for me, they do develop their own character, and I'm keen to see actually what kind of character develops when we get to a 4-hour, if that's what eventually does come to play, WEC race, as well as an 8-hour, a couple of those races too on the calendar. You know, it's going to be interesting to see what dynamics come out of that wash. Let's wait and see.
Graham, let's take a very quick break and then come right back and gather up a handful of final questions to carry us through to the conclusion of this week's episode. PNC is proud to sponsor Scott Dixon, driver of the number 9 car for Chip Ganassi Racing. Scott knows that the road to Victory Lane starts today. Copyright 2018, the PNC Financial Services Group Incorporated. All rights reserved. PNC Bank, National Association, member FDIC. All right, our pal, Shay Adam, she of excellent word talking into microphones during sporty car races fame, sends in some sort of fun question each week, and she has not disappointed. Shay says, you can forcibly ride swap any two drivers in NASCAR and F1. Who and why? For me, Daniel Ricciardo and Kyle Busch. I can't help feel that Daniel would blend well to the American culture and that Kyle would be faster than people expect. That's a good one, Shay. I completely agree on good old Danny Rick. I think he is so mentally adaptable that you could put him in anything and he'd be game for it, whereas not every driver, not just F1, but in many disciplines, just they kind of like the same thing. They like their sandwiches with the edges cut off, and they want exactly this, and it's just consistency. Ricciardo strikes me as someone where you're like, oh, okay, unicycle racing, I'm in. A hybrid unicycle racer, sure, even better. Kyle, on the other hand, I think he has blinding speed, Graham. I think that has been clear from the outset. I also believe he has matured greatly in recent years. I also think that he does not have the mental elasticity to adapt to all of the difficulties and challenges he would face in F1. Kyle, while I think if we're talking straight up qualifying, clear track, could he just shock the world in a proper F1 car? Absolutely. Could I see him throwing a tantrum, throwing things at other drivers? What can I yank out of the... Do I need this knob? Nope. Clang! And where is there a drink bottle I can hurl at somebody? I could see some red-misted tantrums going on and, stuff where Santino Ferrucci doing a lame little hit job from behind on his teammate on a cool-down lap at the Silverstone F2 race. I think Kyle would show the world how to properly take someone out if he was disenfranchised, teammate or not. So,
anything. I actually did watch for the first time in quite a while, watch the Grand Prix at the weekend at Spa-Francorchamps. And apart from the blindingly obvious every single year first turn smash-a-rooney, it was beyond tedious, is the honest answer. Anything to add some character into it. I'll add just this. I'm not going to offer a NASCAR driver into F1, frankly, because I don't know enough about them. But I'd like to see Romain Grosjean adopt his clear Ballad of Ricky Bobby, Jean Girard, alter ego. That I'd like to see. Or what about, I know he's not in NASCAR anymore. What about that Montoya bloke? He might be good in Formula One.
Could be. It's funny. While we've been recording, our dear pal JPM texted me to ask if I'd had or heard any updates on Robert Wickens, which again just speaks to whatever you might think of JPM. The guy does have a big heart and does care. JPM would be a blast. You know who I think? And again, Shay sends in great and funny questions every week, but this one we might actually get a little introspective with, having gotten to know him the tiniest of tiny amounts and seen him work outside of his normal discipline, Jimmy Johnson really strikes me as someone who, above the natural speed and talent, he is so hyper-focused in his approach to what he does. He's, a 97-time NASCAR champion. He is the type who strikes me that, yeah, he's a little bit older, I realize, far from a spring chicken, but someone who, even at 42 years old, is someone that, given the challenge of going to Formula One, having to learn the cars, learn systems, just everything, this is a guy that strikes me, he could rock up and have the absolute right mindset to digest it all, process it all, and succeed faster than almost any other NASCAR driver I can think of. The guy is machine-like in that capacity. So, and then again, you add the fact that he is an umpteen-time champion. Whatever Formula One, top Formula One drivers have to deal with in terms of media requests and constant inundations there, yeah, in NASCAR, it is brutal. And when you're Jimmy Johnson, the guy who's been on top for so long, I don't think there'd be a thing that fazed him. And I think perspective-wise, he would be someone who would really be excellent at getting into F1 and having a better chance of succeeding than anyone else. I think on the Formula One side, now that's interesting. Who could go the opposite way and do well? Part of me thinks Jan's boy Kevin Magnussen, having raced some Thunder Sports cars and such in Europe, obviously, but having driven some non-open wheel cars before and seemingly having enjoyed himself, I think he might be adaptable to do something like that. Just trying to think who else. Naturally, we'd want to say Carlos Sainz Jr. It's built into him of handling unruly things on unfirm pavement and or lacking grip. But part of me also thinks maybe a Brendan Hartley, now that he's an F1 driver. Could he?
Well, you know, he's used to mixing it up in close proximity. But is it me? Am I being too negative? Or are they just a terrifically tedious lot?
Well, keep in mind that Kimi Raikkonen, while trying to decide if he was going to
keep being... The answer to every question is Kimi.
Yes. If while deciding whether he wanted to be left alone because he knows what to do, there was some NASCAR stuff that he did, and I seem to recall it might have even been with Kyle Busch or one of the Busch brothers or something. So... Kimmy's a rolling party. That I think that's the guy. And, you know, he is a DGAF, don't give a bleep all-star. I think he would easily come back to NASCAR and just have fun. I don't know if he'd want to do the 38 weekends per year plus testing. But, yeah, if we were able to sign him up for 10 or 15 races, just show up. You know, have a couple of drinks, party like hell, get into some crashes, get into a couple fights, get a couple of bad tattoos, have a few teeth knocked out, go home, rinse, repeat 10 or 15 times. Kimmy's the only one that stands out to me who could probably live the NASCAR lifestyle and really go home happy with it. So,
well, let's just rattle through another couple of the more light-hearted ones. Nathan Brown says, last week we had referenced an old Depeche Mode song and Doc Martin boots. So with that in mind, I ask you this. What music are you listening to at the moment?
Well, other than the music of your voice, Graham Goodwin.
Thank you.
Oh, see what I did there? I actually had to reboot my computer because Skype was giving me the middle finger, so I didn't open up iTunes. Let me see. Go back to see what I most recently
I'll tell you what, while you're doing that, I'll tell you what I'm looking at because it's reasonably pertinent. I actually went and bought my daughter some music the other week, and it was one of those two-for-one deals, and I picked up the soundtrack from Baby Driver, which, by the way, if you're looking for a fairly recent movie which mixes really some excellent tunes in with the action beautifully, well, you know, either the Guardians of the Galaxy films, which are genius in terms of introducing a new generation to all the tunes, Baby Driver I thought was fantastic. So yeah, thoroughly enjoying the a huge mix of tunes there, including my all-time favorite band, which is a band you may or may not know of, MP, called The Damned.
Yes, I love The Damned. That's a wonderful band. Well, according to iTunes, I have been listening to most recently the late but just one of the all-time great DJs and music producers, Jay Dilla. The Cars. I went back and bought their first album. I loved The Cars growing up, so I've been listening to that quite a bit. Band of Horses is another one. Danger Doom, which is a little combo act, a hip-hop combo act. Mastodon, Aretha Franklin, and what else? I'll just throw a couple of other ones. It seems like I've been, and this is actually a really serious window into my brain, Graham, which is sad, so people cover your ears or take cover. The way I search through music is I will have a band name that comes to mind, and I will go to that, whatever the name is, and I will then tend to wear out the letter of whatever the first name of that band is. So, as I'm learning here, I don't remember which one I went to first. But the band, The Music, I've been listening to a lot, along with Morrissey, McCoy Tyner, Massive Attack, and Mastodon. So, yeah, as you can tell.
Eminem.
Idiot Pruitt. Yes, Marshall Mathers Pruitt, Eminem. Apparently I got stuck on the M's recently. And, yeah, there's more for me to walk through. So I don't know if that's the least bit entertaining, but it's also very sad. At least an opportunity to understand my brain and its malfunctions.
We'll finish off with a couple of the more light-hearted ones at the end of this one, very end of this one. But let's just rattle through a couple of LMP ones. Stuart Hart, how is Super Season and the 2019-2020 winter season affecting teams' planning? Are we likely to see teams joining WC mid-season in hope of getting a Le Mans 19 entry? We are going to see some guest entries, more news on that in the coming months. But no, you are not going to see any further full season entries, simply because that doesn't allow, isn't allowed by the rules. The whole point here is you commit to a full season and you get your two Le Mans races. But we will see some guest cars. We know that one or two people who've requested guest cars have been turned down because one or two races are full. More news on that one as well. Any news and any updates from Onroke, Orica, Dallara, etc. about the new GTP regulations in terms of timelines and interest? It's all going to be governed by the budgets that come out, in particular where we look towards the potential for privateer entries. Everything else in terms of privateers, other than what ultimately the figures are going to be concerned, is going to be covering fire. So what you should be looking for coming forward is a figure of €50 million per two-car team or less. And if you don't get that, you're not going to be getting much of a privateer entry at all, if any. So, yes, we've got that, all we're talking about here in terms of which factories might line up behind those regulations. And, you know, whilst, yes, correctly, there have been a couple of tales of doom, it's not quite as doom-laden as some would have you believe. And I did overhear somebody who was telling tales of doom having to apologise to one of those manufacturers for misinterpreting their lack of attendance at a meeting. Should always go and ask them first, dear colleague. But beyond that, what does it cost to go racing with a non-hybrid LMP1 car? I can only give you the figure that was given to me by Hugh Deshonak. It is that €15 million. That is, he says, the absolute upper limit that beyond which you will not get any takers whatsoever. And his actual view was that you're looking, couple of tens of percentage points lower than that if you're going to get multiple takers. So you're talking somewhere between 10 and 12 million for a two-car season at the moment. John Sable says he's been surprised by how many teams have jumped in the formula despite it only having a lifespan of 3 calendar years. Quite correct. Then we get into three other questions. Is it Turtinen? That's either a slight misnomer or it's slightly Finnish names.
That's the name for Finnish turkey, yes.
Absolutely. If they developed an LMP1 to non-hybrid rules, how much faster would they be compared to the current field? A lot faster. Why? Because they've got the money to spend on the engine technology and they've got the money to spend on the aerodynamic technology, and they're darn good at it. If you'd seen their facility, you would understand why I'm actually giving you that answer. The answer there is that they are good at what they do. They have excellent resources. And they know how to use them to the best of their abilities. As to the GTP and hypercars, yes, all the focus has been at the moment, correctly again,
car.
On car car on the is Toto going to do it? If it happens, yes, they are. Aston Martin, highly likely. McLaren, possibly, probably. Others, let's wait and see. But beyond that, then you get into the fact that this is where they've been, let's say, clever. Hypercar means hypercar. It means concept car. It means all sorts of other things might come into it. Don Gregory says he's read recently about Colin Collis and by Collis' team starting a potentially new hypercar program. Do you have any news if he could be constructor? No reason why he shouldn't be, is the honest answer. Then our good friend Jim Glickenhouse, the amazing Jim Glickenhouse. And if you've had the opportunity, by the way, to have a look at pictures of Pebble Beach and the Concours d'Elegance there, you'll have seen Jim wheeling out his rebuild of the spectacular Pininfarina Modulo concept car. First time that has been a mobile piece of art based on, I think, a Ferrari Boxer back in the day, but the most amazing, stunning piece of machinery. Swoopy just doesn't do it any justice whatsoever. But Jim Glickenhouse, keen to see whether or not there's a way in for his aspirant, very much US-based Mark. Could that be a way forward into the new regulations for that sort of operation? Why shouldn't it be? You know, might we see the likes of Koenigsegg or Pagani? I think unlikely, but never say never. You know, if you've got somebody that just wants to go and do it, can persuade a racing operation to put a program together, can persuade the operating company to deal with the IP issues, these are the kind of things that might emerge. Are they definitely going to happen? No. Might they? Yes. Announcing the death of a category before we've even seen the rules does seem to me to be a bit of a fool's errand. Let's wait and see. Let's give it the opportunity to breathe, and let's get the hard questions asked around the money, after which we can start talking about numbers.
I'm going to grab two here that are somewhat related. First one from Joe Izzo said, Marshall mentioned silhouette possibility for GT cars, and that was my personal desire to just have that become a thing again, a popular thing. And Joe says, back in the 80s and 90s, when I was involved with the team, we were able to cross over in series. Most likely, I'm guessing that would be Trans Am and IMSA GTO. He said we would run Trans Am or IMSA GTO American Challenge, where it was cost effective. Any chance IMSA thinks about this to help car count? That would be a big fat no, Joe. Unfortunately, no. The days of, hey, we're going to build something in our shop, fabricate it by hand, make cut steel tubing, make box frame, whatever, come up with some fun exaggerated bodywork and go play with it. That is the domain of the SCCA Trans Am series, which still is going forth, although not as big as it once was, but still awesome. But no, I've heard nothing about IMSA considering that. And then Corey says, morning, gentlemen. My question is this. If you could add a vintage IMSA car to the GTLM platform, which one would it be? And I'm going to go right back in Joe's direction, having seen it last weekend. I would say Mazda's four-rotor IMSA GTO RX-7. And not only because it was awesome and fast and looked amazing, but because it sounded so incredible, Corey. So if we're talking about trying to bring something that would spice up GTLM, although it doesn't really need any spice because it's already amazing, a quad rotor car making your ears just smile and bleed in the shape of an RX-7, that to me would be just kind of sort of the best thing in the world.
I really thought you were going to say the Audi 200 for a moment there, but clearly
well,
not. Well,
yeah, it would be nice. The same hymn book here. I mean, you know, the folks would expect that.
In a similar vein, by the way, asking about the tube frame thing, DC3, again, one of our Reddit contributors. Thanks, guys. Since retirement, the Gibson LMP2 in the WEC and the old PC cars in America, haven't seen any open top prototypes in high level sports car racing. Do we think they'll ever return to the sport? Has that curtain closed for good? The latter. Just look at the hysteria that followed the first corner incident at Spa and the debate about the halo in Formula One. Frankly, if it was a choice between closed cockpit cars and adopting an open cockpit car with something that looked like that, I'd go for a closed cockpit car every single day of the week. For no other reason forgetting for a moment, and I don't mean that in a dismissive fashion, forgetting for a moment the safety aspects of the device, the reality from my point of view is it just gives you a better proportion looking vehicle. I'm not going to get into the ins and outs of Halo. I don't like it. I'm not going to offer an opinion as to whether or not it would have meant serious injury for the gentleman concerned at the weekend. It's for others to judge. But in sports car racing, yes, I think, unfortunately, it is the end of open top cars for the very foreseeable future. And closed top cars, it's going to be. And it's all to do with the safety debate.
But why not convertibles? Right? You're in the car, you're racing, you're having fun, you reach up to the top, you wind the little crank, and you just open the roof a little bit.
That'd be nice, wouldn't it?
Okay.
We did have some years ago, by the way. Very, very unusual to see an open top car in GT racing currently. But some years ago, in the early years of the Morgan Aero 8, which had various iterations of racing version, we did have a couple of cup class versions of that in the British GT Championship. And one of those cars, I may have put its first race. Clearly, some of the assembly hadn't been what you might have hoped at Donington Park, and roaring down the straight. Or the straightaway, as Matthew Guy Richard last year was asking us what that means, off blew the top. And they did allow that car to race in topless form. Obviously, it's got a roll cage, a full roll cage in the car, but did race without its hardtop.
I am so disappointed in you, Goodwin, for failing to mention the all-time greatest open-top GT car, the Cannibal.
The Cannibal.
You know,
it's back again. We did have, there was it Daytona? Was it, well, the BMWs lost its roof? Am I right?
Boy, that is sounding familiar. And I just happened to pull up, first of all, we've had a self-imposed limit of mentioning BOP three times per episode. I think we haven't, have we even used one? In a question or a conversation? Well, we use EOT. We've never set an EOT limit. I don't know if we've gotten into BOP.
It's so much more fun.
But I'm thinking we're now up to almost one Cannibal reference per episode. So maybe the opposite here. We must find at least one reason to mention the Cannibal per episode.
Gotta be done.
And I just brought up when the car's for sale page here at Fantasy Junction, and which is actually based very nearby here in the Bay Area, and I love the all caps close and comments. Chevrolet Power, 4-time 24-hour Daytona finisher, with many spares, fuel rig, 7 sets of wheels, body molds, period. And then here comes the all caps close, all offers considered. I've got a dog named Larry. Would you take him? No? Okay.
I've got a cracker here, only because I've got one of those little nuggets of information, which I'm going to share with the listener.
I have a roundel of cheese. Would you take that, Cannibal? Sorry.
Comes from Graham Ingleby, and he asks, why are tires always black? Surely someone could brand them these days. The answer is they weren't always black. Back in the day, the early part of the 20th century, most tires were not black. It was a compound called carbon black that came into the production process that made them as black as they were. And that it was some ludicrous level of durability that added into what previously had been white or an off grey or even translucent colour. Now, here's the bit that came my
question. I tell you what.
It was a company called Binney and Smith that first developed that process that brought carbon black into the tire industry. What product did Binney and Smith make, which is absolutely a household name that across the whole world? And it's nothing to do with tires.
I don't know, but is there any relation to the 2007 LMP2 class winner at Le Mans, Bill Binney?
No, it's a different spelling of Binney. I'll tell you what it is. It's Crayola crayons. Binney and Smith, who basically revolutionized the tire industry, are now the company that make Crayola crayons. I think they make that crazy putty as well. But Crayola crayons and every modern tire come from the same basic company, that company discovery of carbon black back in very early 20th century, and by the time we got into the second decade of the 20th century, they'd completely changed absolutely everything about that product. So, good question, Graham, and
Well,
that is the
yeah,
answer.
and I love this one too, because the second part of it was surely someone could brand them these days.
They can.
Yeah, Michelin, Cooper Tire, sponsor of our own podcast. I've seen Goodyear,
You can.
Pirelli,
You can.
Continental.
There is a great. I remember that this came up before because that may have been Pirelli said something about offering these things. There's another reason, by the way, that it would be frowned upon to actually have different coloured tyres because actually it leaves a hell of a mess on the road. It leaves a hell of a mess. You don't want multicoloured race tracks and roads. If you look at the race tracks with a different kind of vision on it. I remember walking along the Yas Marina circuit before the Gulf 12 Hours 2 or 3 years ago. And as you walked under one of the overbridges there, look up, and it is spattered with bits of tire debris. You're not one or two, hundreds and hundreds. And it's when you're down at track level, particularly when there's been track action, you see the kind of the debris and actually the damage that's done by the kind of the tire break off, the tire rub off on these things. Imagine that in every colouring Crayola's rainbow. It would be a bit of a trip, wouldn't it, really?
So there were some great photos from Formula One in 1986 or so, and it was the Benetton team, and this was shortly after they'd taken over the Tolman F1 effort, sponsored by Benetton, obviously, but using Pirelli tires, I believe, and it could have been 85. I might be off by a year, but Benetton, known for their colors, had painted at least the sidewalls of some of the tires and left them out, and they looked glorious. And it really did make me think, well, that would be just a fun thing to do for different style and design and livery and such. Hey, is your car purple? Well, why not paint the sidewalls purple and then obviously apply the tire brand logo on top of that. But I really appreciated that, and there were some folks who took great photos of just a little bit of tire artistry being done. I don't think it lasted very long, but it looked great, and not on the actual tire carcass itself touching the ground, but just the sidewall. So I thought that was purdy and whatnot. Okay, speaking of purdy and whatnot, Mr. Graham, we've got probably about 5 minutes to spare.
Okay.
Why don't we try and find one or two that
I've got a couple.
are fun and or fitting of our vaguely lucid brains?
Well, I've got a number here that you've not got because they were latecomers. Okay.
Holding out on me.
And okay, right. It is one from Jeremy Charette and one from Lee Tucker. Jeremy Charette. Graham, a thousand thanks for saving my last name from Marshall Pruitt butchering a couple of weeks ago. That's
Oh,
outrageous.
man.
No, really. Like many of us, his automotive obsession began with cars he could fit in his pocket, Hot Wheels and Matchbox. This is a subject close to my heart. If you could see what I can see from where I'm standing, you'd understand why. If you could pick any sports car, old or new, what would you love to see immortalized in toy boxes, imaginations everywhere? I should explain. In my not a shed, my office here, I have two very narrow window ledges, and they just about fit Hot Wheels size cars, about 1/64th scale, on them. And both are indeed lined with various near or actual race replicas from all around the world. And if you ever see me at an airport, you ever see me, you will see me walk into toy stores or supermarkets and just have a shuffle through. There's what I'm looking for at the moment because I know Hot Wheels have done an Acura NSX GT3 and I've not got it yet. But I have probably 100 of these things, going all the way back to the 50s and including some of the lovely little Spark models they do. So, some very contemporary LMP1 cars, the Delta Wing they've done, an LMP2 Alpine. What would I most like? I got it 2 weeks ago. I have got some fine scale models of the McLaren short and long tails, but I knew there was a Hot Wheels version of that car, and I
Ooh.
finally got it. A short tail McLaren F1. It's in glorious DSC orange, and I'm looking at it right now, and it makes me very happy.
This isn't so much of a fit in the pocket matchbox thing, so I apologize. I mean, Graham is a perfect answer for this. The only thing that really comes to mind I've tried to buy as many models of the race cars that I've worked on as a mechanic or engineer, or whatever, throughout the years. Unfortunately, I've worked for a lot of smaller mid-sized teams, which means that we were kind of crappy and didn't do many things to deserve having models made of the things that I worked on. But the one that I really did want and saw was finally available and got, which further proved how silly I am sometimes, Graham, is having been a
Cannibal?
part. Now look, I would buy the car outright if I could and have that as a
You can
one-to-one
get a model of the
scale.
cannibal. You
Yes.
can get a model of the cannibal.
It was the last Spirit of America land speed record car that I
Ooh.
worked on in, oh, I'm apologize, 97, maybe 6, 7. I think it was 97. And so here's just the funny, dumb thing. So it was an honor to be a part of that program. I think I was out there for about 2 weeks in the Black Rock Desert. Obviously, we lost the thrust SSC, broke the sound barrier on land. It was amazing. So I realized that we weren't the winning competitor, but great pride. Craig Breedlove, to me, just an American hero, maverick, etc., with his Spirit of America land speed record efforts. So when I finally saw that a scale model of the final 96, 97 era Spirit of America jet car was available, I'm like, oh, this is great, amazing. And having worked on it, I mean, this thing is 12 miles long. It is a massive vehicle. Whatever it was, Graham, my brain just didn't quite compute because I've owned 1/43rd scale models. By then, I'd had a number of 1/18th. And I trying to remember, but whatever size they said that it was, I was like, okay, great. And it might have been 1/18, whatever it was. I just remember finally seeing it for sale in a memorabilia shop and going, okay, hold on. Because this thing, even at scale, was, freaking up, taking half of the room. And so I believe I ended up buying one, but it was just one of those things where in my head, I'm like, oh, that's cute. I'll get a little scale version of it. Now it's like, well, we need to build an extra wing on the house to fit this thing because even in scale, this thing's a giant. So that's one that I really love. Really, really,
Well,
really love.
I've actually literally, while you were telling that tale, just forwarded to you an email I received last week from the publisher of a new, soon to be published, rather, Craig Breedlove biography, The Fast Life
Wow.
in Cars of Racing Legend Craig Breedlove. Apparently, an approved biography. So that could be interesting moving forward, couldn't it? That may be one to bring to another show once I've had a chance to read it. Right, what else have we got here?
Take us home, Mr. Goodwin.
Here we go, Lee Tucker. What races would you consider must attend? I've been going to the Daytona 24 Hours since I was a kid. Love how the entirety of the track is accessible and visible. Always wanted to go to Le Mans, Bathurst, Nürburgring, Laguna Seca, and more. But what experiences are truly worth it in person? Which ones am I better off watching on TV? I'll answer first. I don't know what your financial situation is, Lee. I don't know what the family commitments. I don't know what available finance you've got. Make a plan, a life plan, and go and see the lot. They are all absolutely fantastic. Laguna Seca clearly more accessible if you're on the US side of the world, but Bathurst, pure motorsport. Everything about the place, the town, everything about it. Whether or not it's the 12-hour, whether or not it's the 1,000. Bathurst, I can't recommend highly enough. Nürburgring, amazing. The 24 hours for me is one of the marquee events, totally different to anything else on the planet. Le Mans, you've said it very eloquently, MP before now, is very well worth seeing. Those three, I think, nail it for me in terms of my world. I would add to that, and I'm sure you'll have lots to say on this one, the Indy 500. It's certainly still on my bucket list. The Isle of Man TT, very much on the bucket list. But in terms of endurance racing, come up with a plan. Make it early. Find a cheap flight. Find a cheap way to actually stay on site, camp, whatever. Pick up a $20 tent at a store. Fill it up with boiling water noodles and just have a ball with your fellow humans for a very long weekend in a field, rain or shine, and just glory in the fact that you can tell your friends, your children, your grandchildren, I saw it.
since we have touched on this a few times in the past with questions, Graham, and I've mentioned Bathurst, Le Mans, Indy. I'll mention a few others, and they are somewhat uniquely American, probably not all, but throw a few things out there that I've seen before, been part of before, that would possibly be well below the radar and have nothing to do with endurance racing, but that's fine. First of all, flat track motorcycle racing is one of the craziest, coolest, most jaw-dropping things you can witness. You are convinced that psychotics have been let out of the local Nutter House and been given motorcycles to try and race. That's just crazy to see. There's another thing that is its four-wheel equivalent, and whether it is midgets or sprint cars, either winged or non-winged sprint cars on dirt, it's another thing where you just, it's hard to grasp that human beings want to do this without someone holding a gun at them, because the risks look to be just so disproportionate to maintaining one's status as a living person. But just 800 plus horsepower sideways on a bull ring, you walk away thinking, whatever I've been amused by in motor racing in the past has just become third or fourth tier status. So just be prepared for that. Last one I'll mention, and it by chance happens to be coming to one of my local racetrack homes, Sears Point / Sonoma Raceway. This is the SCCA National Runoffs, which is held once a year. The location changes throughout the country. You name it. It tends to go to any and all of the major road courses. But this is the culmination of all of the amateur racers who have spent the year competing, trying to make it to the National Runoffs. There are, Graham, I don't know, 30 classes, 50 classes, I forget, but it's from showroom stock type vehicles to very small, low powered open wheel cars to GT, to Silhouettes, to this, to that, Form Atlantic style cars, all manner of things. And you get hundreds upon hundreds of entries. It is the finest of amateur road racing in North America that all descends on one venue for a week, and it's just cool. It is so cool.
Something about the runoffs, really, it is now almost unique in the world. It is effectively a national finals week. We don't have that in Europe anymore. You might have a championship or maybe two series come together, but that, it is utterly unique. And there is something about club and national level motorsport that just feeds the enthusiasm like nothing else. And I'll tell you something, I bet there's a very large number of people that over the years have changed from being a fan to a participant, whether or not in the driving seats or on the sidelines, as a result of meeting the people that you meet there. There are no finer group of people than the motorsport family, as far as I'm concerned. And that is the kind of event, isn't it, MP, that just feeds that enthusiasm.
It's the most meaningful achievement in my career, and I've worked on bigger open-wheel teams that have won races. Not an IndyCar. I was on pole once with an IndyCar team, but never won there. But won races with teams in Atlantics and Lights and a lot of other stuff. But most meaningful achievement for me as a 23-year-old mechanic was winning the 93 SCCA National Sports 2000 Championship in a Swift DB5. And you just got right to the heart of why I love it and why I would recommend it. We can spend time on this show on a weekly basis grousing about, oh my God, the EOT is so far off, and what are they thinking? Do they even know how to count? And driver ratings and blah, blah, blah. And then you go to a club race or something like this, the Big Daddy, the National SEC National Runoffs, and it is folks who don't care the least bit about BOP, EOT, Super Silver, Sneaky Silver, none of it. I love it. I have my little thing that I either built or that I bought or that I've tested and developed, whatever. This is just folks who love racing for the purity of it and want to get up to the pro ranks for many of them, but this is the absolute genesis of where it all starts. That initial path, it's where I came up in SCCA racing, and just the passion for it that led to the life that I've been so fortunate to have since, you know, my teens. Heck, even being 3, 4, 5 years old, being dragged around to SCCA races that my dad raced in, Graham. So I would just say that, of course, all the highlights are super easy. Monaco F1 and Le Mans, but we know these things. They're amazing. Go do them. But if you like a little bit of the stuff just beneath the current midget and sprint racing, dirt, you know, American short track, dirt oval racing, flat track racing with motorcycles, and this one in particular, SCCA National Runoffs, oof, you are not going to be disappointed. Speaking of not disappointed, I just enjoyed myself on our little episode, Mr. Graham Goodwin.
Me too. I mean, I'm going to add just one more thing in, simply because it was mind-blowing, and that's Top Fuel track racing. It's not something I want to go and see every week, but I've only been once. Thank you, Chuck Dressing. Spent a fantastic afternoon in the company of the late departed, dear departed, Bob Snodgrass at Gainesville, and watched the Top Fuel cars literally explode. Astonishing stuff. If you get an opportunity to go and see it, go and see it. If it's something you want to keep going and see, great. I'd love to see it again. I don't feel as if I need to do it every week. I just wanted to say this. We are just going to wrap it up. Apologies we've not got to a number of the questions. If you want us to have another crack at it, please submit the same question again. Don't feel it's not that your question hasn't made the mark. We just run out of time for the number of questions that we're getting. But feel free to put the same question in again. I'll generally kind of do a run through these, and MP and I will have a quick chat as we're coming through. But this is the way this show is going to work moving forward. So if there's something that still burns your curiosity, please pop it in there, drop us a line, and, you know, you're frankly, now what we've got in terms of relative to this show, you define the direction which this show goes. You, MP, have got to get busy and on the road again.
Yeah, on a flight, 7 a.m. flight Thursday morning to Portland, with IndyCar returning to Portland for the first time since 2007. Home Sunday night, then in the office Monday through Wednesday, then down to WeatherTech Raceway Laguna Seca Thursday morning for 4 days of IMSA, then home Sunday night, then home for 3 days, then back, then up to Sonoma for the IndyCar season finale, Thursday through Sunday. Then I think I have a weekend off, then back to Monterey for Rennsport Reunion, and then I think I've got a weekend off after that, then Petit Le Mans, and then the runoffs after that. And then, kind of, sort of, mid-October is an off season. Ha! I can't wait. Yeah. So
not by next week's show, but by the week after, I will have driven, and hopefully not destroyed, the fastest car I'll have ever have driven in my life. I'm not going to tell what it is yet, because there's still a little bit to do to actually make this happen. But by the time I speak to you for the second time on your travels, I will have done that, and I'll have done that on a Grand Prix track that is not in the UK.
Wow. Well, I'm a big fan of Porsche 924s, so I can't wait to hear back on the report. Mr. Goodwin, you are a riot. And don't forget, everyone, hashtag oily dog on a rope. That is Graham's new one from this week. I don't think I made up a word. I usually make, last week, I think I made up trank when I was trying to say track. I don't know if I made one up this week, so I've failed you, dear listeners. I apologize. But maybe next week I can get tripped up and my old lips might not produce the word that my brain is saying that it should. All right. I am Marshall Pruitt. That is Graham Goodwin. You're listening to The Week in Sports Cars on the little podcast named after me, supported by both Cooper Tires and PNC Bank. And we'll speak to you next week.